A lot of my colleagues, whom I knew before WAC, Jesse Jackson, Dr. Hevesy, Dr. Schwartz, friends. Let me say at the outset that one of the most practical projects in Black Jewish relations that occurred to me this evening as I walked into this platform suggested that maybe the first thing Jesse Jackson and I ought to do was organize a Black Jewish collection plate for an audience like this. I don't know about Jesse's experience in Baptist churches, where I spend a good deal of time with many Baptist friends, but the guy looks like Young Kipper, the overflow service tonight. I want to, begin at the outset, pay tribute to the respect for scholarship, biblical scholarship that's implicit in the way in which this evening has been organized. There was a wonderful story told during Vatican Council II. When I was present while the Vatican was facing up for the first time in some 1900 years to what has been the relationship of the Catholic Church to the Jewish people and what had to be faced, what had to be repented from, what had to be changed. During the course of the council, someone told me this story. The late Blessed Pope John the 23rd, whose inspiration it was to organize Vatican Council II, which literally changed the course of the history of the Catholic Church for the past 1900 years. Before he was elevated to the papacy, served as the apostolic delegate in the Balkans, in Istanbul. And then after that, he was brought to France, where he there served as the apostolic delegate to the French government, representing the Pope in France. And as the story has it, Monsignor Roncalli, as he was then called, developed a very warm and intimate friendship with the chief rabbi of France, Rabbi Jacob Kaplan. And according to this account, Monsignor Roncalli and Chief Rabbi Kaplan had been invited by the President of France to a banquet held in the Cato Sled. And they came together in this large reception hall and they were chatting, making small talk, exchanging pleasantries. And then someone rang the gong for the banquet for them to walk through the reception hall into the main dining hall. And as this story has it, the chief rabbi came through the door for entering into the banquet, and Monsignor Roncalli was at his side, holding his elbow. And the chief rabbi turned to Monsignor Roncalli and he said, "Your Excellency, after you first." And Monsignor Roncalli, who was very fond of the rabbi, heard him and said, "No, Your Excellency, chief rabbi, you first." And this went on for like 5 minutes back and forth, Alphonse and Gaston routine while they're holding up traffic, people letting them move through the door. Finally, Pope John, then Monsignor Roncalli, in his characteristic Italian, earthen, peasant way, grabs hold of the arm of Chief Rabbi Kaplan, begins to shove him through the door, exclaiming, "No, Chief Rabbi, the Old Testament before the New Testament," and shove him into the back of the hall. Well, normally I would appear after Jesse Jackson, after he has in his powerful, charismatic, mesmerizing way taken over an audience, and I would feel like a schlemiel after that, trying somehow to take hold of what was left over the audience. Well, I guess as an act of pure academic scholarship, the Old Testament, the Hebrew Scriptures, or the New Testament, let Jesse's mother work. The invitation extended to me by the Honorable Alan Eversley, Assistant Majority Leader of the New York State Assembly, and Professor of Political Science at Queens College, and indeed he is right, we have wonderful memories of association with his late blessed father, who served the American Jewish Committee with distinction. Communications on him and from Professor Ernest Schwartz, Dean of Jewish Studies at this college, he is deeply appreciated. Their establishment and support of the Queens Black Jewish People to People Project is both a symbol and a substantive contribution to a vital, compelling goal that hopefully all of us here tonight share. The overcoming of misunderstanding and the advancement of knowledge, mutual respect, and cooperation between the Black and Jewish people and communities in the context of a profound common concern for the welfare of our beloved American Democratic Republic. Let me be clear at the outset about my mandate as I see it this evening. I speak here as an individual, only for myself, exercising my democratic right through speech. While I believe that I may express the feelings and views of many, perhaps most, I don't know, in the Jewish community, what I am about to say does not represent the official positions of the American Jewish Committee, and certainly not those of the American Jewish community, which is characterized by diversity and a plurality of views, as is true of every other religious, racial, or ethnic group in our democratic society. Why are we here this evening? Why is there such an impressive turnout of people in this community coming together tonight at Queens College? This is not an easy evening, either for the Reverend Jesse Jackson or for myself. If the bigots and extremists in our society had their way, this evening would not have taken place. The fact that Jesse Jackson and I made our own separate decisions to share this platform in the face of threats, slanders, and intimidations is a statement of our determination to reject hatred, bigotry, and verbal violence from whatever quarter it is issued. We do not, and we will not, obey the troublesome and disturbing episodes in Black-Jewish relations of the recent past. But our purpose tonight, as I see it, is to try to find a better way, a more civil and constructive way, for Blacks and Jews to live and work together, as they have done, we must not forget, as they have done for much of their history during the past 25 years. I ask, why are we here tonight? And I want to try to answer that question out of my reflections and life experiences during the past quarter century or more. In 1968, I became involved with Catholic and Protestant leaders in trying to relieve the suffering of the victims of the Nigerian-Biafran conflict. That exposure, day in and day out, to so much destruction of human lives, with tens of thousands of deaths of Muslims and Christians, and the incredible starvation of thousands of innocent children, literally transformed my life. While the Jewish agenda, the cause of Soviet Jews who suffer oppression still, the cause of Israel, The cause of peace in the Middle East between Jews and Arabs, the black Jews of Ethiopia, who still suffer incredible oppression and poverty, among other Ethiopians, are constantly at the core of my consciousness. Since that experience of 1968, literally I have been driven to dedicate much of my waking hours to the problems of world refugees, world hunger, and international human rights. There are about some 12 million refugees in the world today, some 6 million of them in Africa, the largest refugee problem in the world, most of them living in desperate conditions. The serious fact is that most of these refugee tragedies to which I have been exposed or been involved are the result of religious, racial, ethnic, and tribal conflicts. In the Sudan several years ago, nearly a million black Christians and animists were massacred by Arab Muslim tribes of the north. In Uganda, President Idi Amin for life and his Nubian tribesmen slaughtered some half-million black Christians, half of them Anglicans, half of them Roman Catholics. In India, there are unending slaughters of Muslims, Hindus, and Sikhs. In Sri Lanka, Tamils and Sinhalese destroy each other, all in the name of God and nation. The Iran-Iraq war has resulted in the deaths of an estimated 250,000 human beings, many of them children 12 to 14 years old, told that by their martyrdom they assure themselves certain ascent to paradise. Lebanon, once the citadel of Arab Christendom, Lebanon once to the Arab Christian world what Israel is to world Jewry. The model of pluralism in the Middle East, as Lebanon has been, is now a daily catastrophe. And who loses sleep over Ireland, where for more than a decade, Protestants and Catholics have been destroying each other? Religious, racial, and ethnic hatreds have become the engine of an epidemic of dehumanization in the world. Nowhere is that dehumanization more palpable and tragic than in South Africa. In October 1985, I went on a mission with the American Jewish Committee, our leaders, to South Africa. We met with a great many representatives from every segment of that blighted society, from Archbishop Tutu, black union leaders, the SASH Legal Aid Society, the leaders of the government, business, and the Jewish community. It is a nightmare, an abomination, to experience the chemistry of nationalist arrogance and religious bigotry. Two massive religious lies have dominated Western civilization, including that of South Africa, which is a Western country. Jews have suffered and have been destroyed by the 1900-year-old religious lie of deicide, the absurd notion that the Jewish people collectively killed Christ and therefore must endure unending punishment in exile. And some fundamentalist Christians who live to this day preach the obscenity that the Nazi Holocaust was God's ultimate punishment of the Jews for having allegedly killed Christ. But apartheid is another such religious law. In the Dutch Reformed churches, it has been taught for generations as gospel truth that the black people have been cursed by God with a curse of Ham, the forebear of black people in the biblical story. Segregation and apartheid have thus been justified as doing God's will. I saw the demonic power of that religious lie as I watched from afar in Soweto in 1985, watched dozens and dozens of young Afrikaans leaping out of their Hippo armored troop carriers there in Soweto, shooting black youths at will. And these young Afrikaans fresh off the farms, their heads filled with their church lessons, have been raised in a culture of religious and racial hatred and bigotry that has been indulged without limit. Where were they to learn that the life of a black child is as precious in the eyes of God as their own? The late psychoanalyst, Dr. Eric Fromm, in his monumental last work, The Anatomy of Human Destructiveness, called such behavior group narcissism. As in the dynamics of individual narcissism, a group attributes to itself all virtue and is consigned to the outgroup all vice, everything inferior. Such a group becomes totally self-centered and sees itself as naturally superior and sees the other as inferior, an infidel, a heretic, deserving of destruction. Dr. Fromm calls such group conflict psychopathic behavior that is responsible for much of the group aggression, terrorism, and violence that pockmarks the world today. The cost in human lives that the human family is paying for such religious and racial hatreds all over the world is staggering, beyond human comprehension. In a nuclear missile age, such psychopathology went out of control, could conceivably, God forbid, trigger off a nuclear holocaust. Blacks and Jews, all Americans need to acknowledge that America is different, has been different, is different. For the past 200 years, our national and religious leaders have struggled mightily to establish an open, democratic, pluralist society. The true genius of America rests not on sending out automobiles and Coca-Cola around the world. True genius of America rests in the reality that each religious, racial, and ethnic group comes to the common American table by right as first-class citizens and not by sufferers. Each group has its own agenda, appropriately, its own deeply felt priorities, and has a right to receive a fair and sympathetic hearing at the shared American table. While advocating its own agenda, at the same time, each of us has a simultaneous, a collateral, and overarching obligation to serve the common welfare. American democracy is founded on a social compact, which is a very fragile instrument. Watergate taught us how fragile. Watergate has taught us how fragile this compact can become. That compact needs to be continuously nurtured by an intense commitment to civility and mutual respect. That does not prevent nor preclude constructive criticism of each other's positions or holding different views. By indulging religious or racial bigotry, reckless and uninhibited racial epithets, or anti-Semitic defamations, can beat this precious, fragile social compact into the ground, into dust. My friends, America is the only nation on earth that has not been despoiled by religious war. We have not had 30-year wars. We have not had 100-year wars of a religious character as one finds all over the European landscape. We have had far too much of racism and anti-Semitism, of lynchings and verbal violence. And let me tell you that the canard, the obscenity, the Zionism, the racism is just such an expression of defamation and verbal violence. Perilous attacks of demagogues and of such moral courage and integrity is credibility made of. At their height, 1960s and the 1970s were a paradigm of democratic pluralism at its best. The essential reason for that extraordinary, indeed historic cooperation was well formulated by our colleague Albert Borstmann, who in an op-ed piece of the New York Times recalled how in 1964, the late Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was challenging, together with Jesse Jackson and Andy Young and many other friends and colleagues, that Dr. Martin Luther King was challenging racial discrimination in public accommodations. In St. Augustine, Florida, there was a fierce resistance from the sheriff and the police, as well as from the White Citizens Council and the Ku Klux Klan. And Martin Luther King sent a telegram to the conference that was then meeting in Atlantic City of the Central Conference of American Rabbis. And he appealed for their help. Literally within hours, that very day, 16 rabbis came to St. Augustine, where they joined Dr. King and his brothers and sisters. They entered the black church and joined in common prayer and mutual solidarity. And then they went off to try to integrate a lunch counter in the face of incredible hatred, contempt, anti-Semitic and racist soliloquy. All of them, Martin King and all around him, and the 60 rabbis, were all forced by electric cattle prods into a cell in the prisons of St. Augustine. A number of them had their lives threatened. Why did these rabbis engage in acts of civil disobedience? Why were they then prepared to go to jail almost spontaneously at once? Horsebound wrote followed. He said, the answer is simple. Martin Luther King Jr. No other person could have evoked such an instantaneous and uncritical response from us. With Dr. King, there was implicit trust, a profound bond of mutual respect, and a deep sense of solidarity with his mission and that of his people. We respected him because he was intellectually keen and a powerful orator. His recital was not too bad either. And Horstmann added, we loved him because he cherished the glory of racial and religious diversity. He despised black separatism as both wrong and counterproductive. He saw the civil rights revolution not as a black rebellion, but as a covenant. White and black, Christian and Jew, standing together for decency. To Dr. King, justice was a seamless web. Anti-Semitism and anti-Catholic prejudice, like racial bigotry, were anathema. His goal was not only justice for America's blacks, but human rights for all peoples and peace everywhere. And then Horstmann adds, if, as I believe, Meir Kahane is essentially a problem Jews must face and resolve, so the Reverend Louis Farrakhan is a central challenge to the integrity and the future of the black community. Are bigger than Louis Farrakhan or Meir Kahane. And we still have much in common that transcends our demagogues and our frictions. As Dr. King never tired of pointing out, blacks and Jews have common enemies, not just in the 1960s. Read the New York Times this week on what is happening on 16 major campuses in America. The racism has begun to erupt again against young black students on college campuses. read what is happening in the Farm Belt of America, where the Aryan Brotherhood, the Christian Identity Movement, and the Posse Comitatus, joining together with Klan, are now trying to create the canard that the decline of the farms of America, the breakdown of the family farms, one of the great tragedies of this country, is due for one reason only. The Jewish conspiracy of America has set out to buy out the farmland of America. It is the Jewish conspiracy that is responsible for the crisis in the Farm Belt. They have not gone away. They're always beneath the surface. We have a shared history of oppression. That gives us a shared vision of a compassionate and open society. And my friends, we need each other. I spoke today to our Washington representative, my bookbinder, about problems related to South Africa. And he talked to me about the incredible closeness, the incredible cooperation between congressmen who are black and the Jews. And he said, no two other groups in the United States Congress vote together as consistently for their respective agendas as do the Jews and black congressmen in the United States Congress. And they are advancing a common agenda, protecting the poor, the increasing poverty, especially among the other class, from the social cuts which have taken place during the past 4 years, working together on the problems of unemployment, on family life, on education, on fair housing, drugs, crime, violence, resisting together the violations of the separation of church and state, which continues to mount from the radical right week after week, together working for the security of the state of Israel, speaking out for Soviet Jews and others denied their human rights, opposing together apartheid in South Africa and racism at home, despite the irritations of the conflicts that cloud black-Jewish relations, even on such anguished issues of affirmative action, where there can be legitimate and constructive criticism, there is still a bond that links Jews and blacks together. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. forged a black-Jewish bond in love, devotion, blood, and dreams. The greatest homage we Jews can pay to his memory, that superb religious leader as a political activist, is to nurture and strengthen that bond, which was and must remain a blessing for America and for the world. I can only hope and pray that this shared evening, with Jesse Jackson, whom I've known for many years, will mark a turning away from the aberrations and the deviations of black-Jewish relations of the past, and will return us to the higher of justice, mutual respect, mutual support, and solidarity. For the sake of the black and Jewish peoples of our nation, and above all, for the well-being of this great American democratic society which we love. Thank you.
Should remember, Cheney, Schwerner, and Goodman. Three young people in the flush of a commitment to principle and idealism, two of them Jewish, one of them black, who went south to fight the civil rights movement non-violently and were murdered in the south because of their commitment. Maybe that's what we should focus on, that kind of real spirit that would compel people to make that kind of sacrifice. Ladies and gentlemen, great privilege for me to introduce a gentleman who was appointed by Martin Luther King early on in his career as director of Operation Breadbasket, which was the economic arm of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. Later in 1971, organized Operation Push, People United to Serve Humanity. I remember reading about it then. What struck me was the theme of this self-help organization, if I may characterize it. The theme of it was people, poor people, oppressed people, victims, fighting their way out of their victimization by themselves, not depending on others, but on their own self-worth, on their hard work, on their own value. Gentlemen later organized the Push for Excellence in Education program. He has been a leader in the Black community for several decades. In 1983, he began his candidacy for President of the United States. He was a leading candidate in the 1986 election. As a politician, I note that he received 3.5 million votes in the primaries, 22% of the vote in the Democratic primary. He won 4 states and Washington, D.C. He is a renowned orator, thinker, philosopher, community leader, not without controversy, but certainly one of the great leaders in America today. Ladies and gentlemen, the Reverend Jesse Jackson.
Pharaoh told the truth to Pharaoh and raised his wrath. They led the Jewish people across the Red Sea on the way to the promised land. A religious leader, Moses, spoke up to the same people. And he came down from Mount Sinai with the Ten Commandments and found them worshiping the golden calf. And this is the finest tradition of religious leaders, to speak the truth, stand up to imperial authority when necessary, and speak out to one's own congregation when appropriate. Always be prepared in God's name to speak the truth as you know it. American history began with religious figures serving as political leaders, led by the ministers of the Pilgrim's Dad, that nameless boy across the Atlantic in search of religious freedom. And yet, ironically, for they value for themselves, they deny to others, forbidding dissension, persecuting Quakers, demanding adherence to strict sectarian life. There are other examples, too, of very religious figures who preach and practice tolerance and respect. The Baptist minister, Roger Williams, founded the colony of Rhode Island on the principles of religious tolerance. The Quaker leadership of Pennsylvania, fleeing persecution at home, offered sanctuary to others. And not coincidentally, fair play to Native Americans. An American first, and too long, an American oddity. Religious figures stepped to the front line of leadership in the fight to abolish slavery. John Brown, Frederick Douglass, both deeply religious, used their talents, put the platforms, pulpits, and their moral authority to speak out against the evil of slavery. Insist that this nation live up to its own best principles of freedom and equality. Meanwhile, in fields and cabins, slaves told each other the story of the Exodus secretly at night, a symbol of hope and redemption. In the black communities of slaves and freedom alike, the religious leader was most often also the political leader. The natural result in small cohesive communities, their own internal social structure, political or no economic resources of political authority. There are similarities between these black communities in the 19th and early 20th century and the Jewish communities of Eastern Europe during the same time. There too, the rabbi was likely to serve as teacher, civic authority, and negotiator with the outside world. Who better to articulate the hopes and goals of his community? Who better, in the tradition of Moses, speak out to civil authorities on behalf of the oppressed? Rabbi Mark Tannenbaum and I come to this meeting to speak from our different perspectives. We begin by acknowledging our common experience. As Jews and African Americans, our people have known what it is like to be slaves. Of all the people in the world, we explicitly remember that experience, reminding ourselves and our children that we were slaves in the land of Egypt and the United States of America. As we remember slavery, we celebrate emancipation. We value and take joy in our freedom, knowing that it is brought to us by God's grace and protected by constant human vigilance. Jews and blacks have traveled different journeys. We share common history, the experience of oppression. Both our people have suffered from harsh and painful government. For blacks, that meant slavery, legislated and enforced by government, followed by years of institutionalized, legalized discrimination, again enforced by the agencies of our own government. For Jews, the memory is of the Holocaust, the horror of rulers gone mad, the murder of millions of human beings, from babies to grandparents, and the search for safety and refuge from which too many of the world's governments turned away. The both of us, the memories are fresh and the lesson clear. Because we've suffered from the murderous attacks of bad in the name of the law, carried out by people even wearing the uniform of the law, because we've experienced a hard governance for evil, we must be totally committed to the standards of government for good of recent history. We'll make our message clear. When President Reagan announced his plans to travel to Bitburg and forgot the Second World War, I was shocked. She got shocked that in spite of appeals from government officials and the public, he would be at heart and remain so insensitive to the feelings of those who had lived through that history. In formulating my own response to this trip, I spoke to people who are authorities on the Holocaust here and abroad. I spoke to you who is there, the Nobel laureate. A Nobel laureate who certainly merits our greatest gratitude and congratulations on an honor well deserved, as well as U.S. Dr. Paul Fox of Boston, the former state education superintendent in Massachusetts, an engineer, a veteran, an African-American. Dr. Fox, a distinguished African-American, told me of his own personal experience as a soldier in the United States, Army in 1945. As a member of the Corps of Engineers, he was with the Black Battalion that was the first to enter Dakar. When those troops approached this death camp, which was so eerie and silent, they were frightened. They thought it was a military camp held by the Germans. It was a death camp. They saw the piles of bodies and knew they were in the presence of an incomprehensible tragedy and constant evil. But they also assumed that German soldiers were hiding within the camp's walls, waiting to attack them. Inside those silent buildings, the remaining Jewish prisoners were huddled in fear. They heard the approaching footsteps and assumed the worst, that German soldiers were returning to finish them off. Then cautiously peering out, they realized these soldiers were black and could not be Nazis. The prisoners, both of whom had never seen a black, rushed out when they saw them. In stark disbelief and in panic relief, they embraced. They were informed. Both were in shock. Both stood momentarily paralyzed on the cutting edge of history. Mutual fear and insecurity had been transformed into mutual security and rescue. Blacks got to the Dachau and Buchenwald concentration camps first. These are stories that must be told and filmed and taught. It is the spirit of those moments of triumph that must be recaptured and nurtured and never let go. When those moments were messages not just for blacks and Jews, but for the suffering and rejecting everyone, for the entire community of the suffering and the survivors, the Hispanics, the Asians, the Arabs, Native Americans, the Central Americans, and the people of the Caribbean. This true story of Dr. Fox and that cow is one of the most important lessons of our time. Invaders, inmates, and liberators each thought the other was the enemy. Separated by the death camp's walls, they feared the worst. But when they opened their eyes, they saw for themselves, they realized the truth, that we must look at each other squarely, to recognize our allies. Walls and ignorance have kept us apart. We must tear down the walls, open our eyes, smile through our tears, open our hearts to one another, to give, redeem, and move on. And so today, when we look at the situation here at home, example of racial conflict. But even more chilling because they wrong the young whom we have such high hopes. We can find many examples of walls of ignorance and fear, which breed insecurity and hatred, that manifest itself in acts of blind and mean violence. Called the prism of racism, we see natural allies kept apart. It's because our beliefs are stronger in that which we have in common. I come here tonight to talk about our common future, our cooperation for the common good. It's because our beliefs are stronger in the ability of people of goodwill to reason together.